Hello and welcome to the Fergan. My name is Dan and I'm here to try and make sense of these turbulent times from a heathen perspective. Visit fergan.com for links, information and an archive of past episodes.
This fire burns as a sign to the sun that it must return, or we shall be left in the ice of eternal blackness. None here, O sun, have forgotten our debt to your warmth and light. Someone here has failed the trust. There is a lawbreaker here who has forgotten the custom. This is a trick. These things cannot be. This is the world upside down, like the image in the lake on a still day.
You are wrong, Wolf. I have seen it.
Who speaks?
It is I, Bran the Raven. And I tell you, the world will be turned on its head.
Raven, you are a liar, just as always. How could anyone who lives under the sun forget the solstice and the old laws? Are you going to tell them how to live off the earth and not in it? How to become its master?
I tell you, where they have passed, the grass is scorched away. And the trees die as if withered by a brush fire. Except that no green shoots follow. They destroy faster than they can grow. The cycles of seed and harvest are no longer something to live by, but something to be altered. The animals are no longer brothers. Slaves.
How could they have forgotten?
Knowledge has made them stupid.
Hello and welcome to the Fergan. I hope you're all enjoying a wonderful Yuletide. I know I said in the last episode with Anders Nilsson, episode number, what was that? Episode number 23, I think it was. I said that there wouldn't be another episode this year, but I kind of lost track of time. As I tend to do sometimes around this time of year, I forget how many days are left in the calendar year. So for this episode, I'm going to do something I've not done in a while, which is to fly solo, just speaking myself alone in a room about a few different topics. There's been a constant stream of really great guests who've very kindly given up their time and to speak to me for the last several episodes now, and I hope you all have enjoyed those. There are a few things I want to talk about in this one, and I was given some ideas for topics of discussion by friends. It will probably end up being a shorter episode than usual, but we'll see how it goes. The first thing I wanted to touch on was I wanted to kind of reiterate something I said in a voice message on the Telegram channel recently. I spoke about what I believe the significance of Yule to be. And I kind of gave some of my own ideas on that, my speculative ideas. And one thing that I wanted to elaborate a bit on was this idea that ritual of the holy tides, of the high festivals, the purpose it serves. You know, I think myself and many of us, when we become interested in paganism, people who may question us about it will ask things like, why do you need to hold ritual? Why do you perform blot? Why do you have to celebrate Easter and Yule and you know, the Midsummer Solstice and the, you know, Alpherblot or Winterfilleth? You know, and if they may be Christians themselves, and they may, their answer may be, well, we celebrate the birth of Jesus because, you know, we are appealing to him. You know, they talk in those kind of terms, but they'll say to us, well, you know, you celebrate Yule or you celebrate the winter solstice as though your doing so ensures the return of the sun, you know, for the next cycle of the year, you know, the lengthening of the day, the rising of the sun above the horizon again, you know, the longer days. You know, they'll kind of accuse us of being primitive or ignorant, or they'll say that our ancestors only celebrated the solstice because they were stupid enough, they were primitive enough to believe that if they didn't do so without fail every year, then the sun wouldn't return or their crops wouldn't perform well, or you know, things like this. So this modern mindset completely disconnects the success of our agricultural pursuits, completely disconnects that from our festivals. And from an empirical point of view, you can see why. Because, you know, for yes, we celebrate so-called Christmas now, but we don't really directly, properly honor Sunna or the sun. You know, some of us, some people will honor the Son of God, Jesus Christ, in their religion. But most people, even those who, you know, purport to celebrate Christmas, aren't really celebrating the Son of God. So it's been a very long time since there's been that connection between celebrating the solstice and the rebirth of the sun. And what I mentioned in my voice message was that, what if we consider it differently? What if we consider the return of the sun the obvious material manifestation of natural order? You know, and that's something which occurs whatever we do. But what if there is a metaphysical side to that cycle, to that natural cycle? What if these principles of natural order, of righteousness, of nobility, of order, of the proper role, gender roles in society, of maintaining this wide array of wonderful ethnic identities that we have across the world, rather than blending everything into a global monoculture, the disconnect from nature, the reliance upon pharmaceutical drugs, the dependency upon the digital society, our focus upon TV screens and phone screens and computer screens rather than nurturing natural, healthy human relationships. All of these things represent an enormous deviation from natural order. I believe that certainly, and I'm sure that many of you listening to this, you know, agree with me on that. So what if, you know, what if we look back at history and we say, right, well, the time when our ancestors started to, when they failed to celebrate the solstice, Yule, for the correct reasons, with the right spirit, with the requisite amount of passion and sincerity, what if by doing that they broke with this kind of this pact, this contract that we have with nature, with the gods, with natural order itself? What if by defying that requirement to honor the solstice, to honor the sun and the cycles, we, even though we still have that material reappearance of the sun and the continuance of the cycles, what if we did lose something in that and we actually lost the more metaphysical aspect of that relationship with the natural order? Now, at the beginning of this episode, I played an edited excerpt from A Yule Tale, which is an old 70s BBC play, which I was introduced to some years ago by a friend of mine called Wolfgar. And I listen to that every year, and I often share it on my channels because I think it's a great reminder of what this time of year is really about and its origins, you know, not in an overly complex or comprehensive way, but it brings it to life. It brings this time of year to life. And I shared that clip at the beginning because it kind of succinctly highlights what I'm trying to say here about our, you know, when we forgot this to engage with this cycle, with the natural order of things, then we broke with Mother Nature. You know, we separated ourselves from her. So yeah, I just wanted to speak a little bit more about that again, because I instinctively feel that there is something to this. I feel like our deviation from Yule, from the solstice, from the midsummer solstice and the other high holy tides has been the real hidden cause for our material degeneracy and disconnect in the modern world, and that to restore natural order in that kind of visible material sense, we need to reconnect with the cycles, with the natural order. We need to honor the festivals as our ancestors did. I'd be quite interested to hear what you all think about that. So if you're listening to this on Odyssey, if you could leave a comment, or if you're a Patreon or Substack or Subscribestar patron, leave a comment or a message, or send me an email. If you go to fergan.com/contact, you can send a message there. And yeah, I'd love to know your thoughts on this. Maybe there are some further kind of attestations, or there are other pagans who have observe this as well and have the same theory or take on the real significant purpose, you know, the practical reasons why we have to celebrate the festivals. Next up, someone suggested that I talk about what I would like to see for the future of our religion. It's a good question, this, and I had a really good conversation with a friend recently, a friend who suffered a horrible workplace accident about a month ago. I went to visit him as he's recovering, and he's not able to leave home. So I went to see him, and he's very embroiled in the world of psychotropic plants. He leads ayahuasca ceremonies, and he's very knowledgeable about these things, and he travels around Europe doing this. And those of you who've listened to the podcast episode with Emma Lucy Shaw will be somewhat familiar with this kind of culture, because I spoke about it with her. Now, it's not something that I know very much about, and it's not something that I have really any experience in, but it is something that I'm open to. And what interested me was speaking to my friend about the Native American practice of consuming or taking peyote, And some of you may have heard of peyote. I was under the kind of ignorant impression that it was actually just their word for cannabis, but it's not. It's a different thing. It's a cactus, apparently. And there's some kind of counterpart to peyote called San Pedro, I think it is, or something like that, which is kind of like the weaker version of it. And my friend was telling me about the peyote rituals that the Native Americans perform. And he said that unlike many of the psychotropic drugs that, or plants, I should say, that are taken in various parts of the world, peyote rituals are very, very formal, very structured, very rigid. They take place in a very specific way. And they're kind of used as, I guess, initiations and things like that. And it got me thinking that this is something which we really don't have in our Northern European or wider European tradition. We don't have these very potent, more, what word could I use? Unhinged, I guess, or not unhinged, but kind of rituals which involve altered states of consciousness. And I know that many heathen groups out there, including the one that I'm involved with, we do, you know, other than performing our blots and symbols, we do do things like runic galda or chanting, and we do do visualization, like group visualization things, but it never involves, or so far has never involved, the consumption or inhalation of these plants. And I'm not saying that we necessarily need the plants to do something similar to this Native American peyote ritual, but I do think that we perhaps need to create and experience these very, I don't know, powerful experiences of an altered state of consciousness in a group setting. Because I think our bloat and symbol can be quite, sometimes there can be, to be honest with you, sometimes it can be a little bit dry. Sometimes it can be a bit too ceremonial, in the sense that you're just kind of going through motions and you're not doing it to necessarily experience something. You're trusting that by performing that ritual as a group, that you are connecting somehow with the gods and ancestors and the forces of nature, but you're not really experiencing anything most of the time. I know that, of course, sometimes it happens, and you know, I've been part of rites where we have experienced things, but for the most part, you don't experience anything outside of your mundane material reality, other than that kind of group connection that you have. So I think, in considering what I would like to see for the future of our religion, I'd like to see these more powerful group experiences of altered states of consciousness, perhaps, you know, and whether that comes about through the use of some kind of plant entheogen, or whether it comes about through ritualistic chanting or drumming, or the Native Americans also have sweat lodges, which don't involve these substances at all. It's just, from what I know, from what I've been told about it, it just involves, it's kind of like a sauna, but to a very kind of overwhelming, intense degree. And in the dark, and for a certain amount of time, and you kind of come out reborn from this sweat lodge. So, yeah, I'd like to see us kind of embrace things like that, because I think we need a more tangible, or should I say less tangible? We need a stronger connection with the gods, the ancestors, the whites, with the other aspects of ourselves, of our soul, as discussed in the episode with Anders Nilsson. we need to strengthen that connection, because when we know of the existence of these things firsthand in no uncertain terms, it's incredibly empowering. And from the few experiences along those lines that I've had, they can enormously embolden you to move ahead with your spiritual path that you're on, as well as with your socio-philosophical political path, even, you know, the way that those aspects of your worldview intertwine together to form a whole, something that you know is right. And when you're given kind of a glimpse behind the veil of reality, so to speak, that what it can be seen and digested by the, you know, the naked material eye, when you realize that there is more to existence than that, it, you know, as Anders Nilsson said, it shows you that there really is nothing to fear. And it also reaffirms the fact that you are on the right spiritual path, that there is, that you are on the right path by following spirituality, you know, at all. And I know that that's the case, and I'm sure many of you know that that's the case, but it's great to have these experiences which remind you in no uncertain terms that this is the case. So, yeah, I mean, there are many things I could say about how I'd like to see the future of our religion and how it ties together with, you know, how we as a folk and as various folks move ahead. I think it would be good to see heathens move geographically near to one another so that we can practice our pagan ways as groups rather than as individuals, which so often seems to be the case in the modern world by necessity. But beyond that, I trust that it will grow naturally, you know, as the interest grows, as people realize that the solution is not political, but actually begins within the individual as a spiritual realization. I'm confident that the heathen and pagan ways will grow in a positive direction. Yeah, I think in future episodes, I'm sure I'll talk more about this. But yeah, for now, I think I'll just leave you with that humble suggestion.
Hey.
homeschooling. People have asked a lot about homeschooling, so I'll just talk a little bit about that. My journey into homeschooling, it was definitely inspired by people like Varg Vikernes of Burtsum. You know, I've been a fan of Burtsum since I was a teenager, and I will never deny that certain aspects of Varg Vikernes' worldview have been highly formative and inspirational to me. And one of them has been his persistent recommendation to homeschool. So before I had children, I was adamant that I wanted to homeschool them. I also have friends within the heathen group that I practice with who homeschooled their children, and they offered me some invaluable guidance to doing that. And one of the things that my good friend Hammerson said to me was, you simply raise your children. That's really what it boils down to. You know, it's natural to overthink what homeschooling really entails. You know, people think that, you know, if you would normally send your child to school for 6 hours a day, 5 days a week, that you then have to organize 6 hours worth of lessons for them at home. And that's not the case. You simply raise them yourself. And one of the things that we've done since our children were very young is to always encourage them to ask questions. So if they want to understand, you know, how something works, what, you know, what clouds are, where clouds come from, what causes snow, or what this animal is, or what the difference between that type of bird is and that type of bird, or, you know, just any questions that they have about the world that they're experiencing as young human beings, we encourage them to ask. And if we don't know the answer to be able to explain it to them, we look it up with them. You know, obviously you have to stay on top of certain fundamental things, especially reading, writing, mathematics. And we do that, but that certainly doesn't take hours every day. In fact, we find that our children thrive best on short bursts of learning, you know, so just even just 15 minutes of reading practice a day and 15 minutes of mathematics, they seem to absorb it better then. One of the things that we found is that our eldest child, she's actually seeking to do these things herself. The other day, for example, I found that she had been writing sums for herself and then answering or writing the answer to those sums herself. So she'd been giving herself homework, essentially, because that's how much she enjoys learning and testing herself. And one of the reasons that another of the reasons that I wanted to homeschool was because, and I'm sure that many of you out there have this exact same experience as well, when you were at school, learning was a chore. It was something that was forced upon you. Homework was a chore. Going to school was a chore. You got to see your friends. Maybe you enjoyed sports lessons. You know, maybe there was a girl that you fancied or a boy that you fancied, whatever. You know, there were things that you liked about school, but for the most part, you'd rather not have gone. And that's because you're sat in a class with certain information being forced down your throat. And for the most part, it's never really explained to you why you need to know these things. You know, you go to maths lessons, it's never explained to you why you would ever need to know algebra or trigonometry or whatever. And, you know, a book that I've mentioned a few times in the series of doing this podcast is Fingerprints of the Gods by Graham Hancock, which, you know, I read that when I was in my late teens, after I'd left school and college. And that was actually the moment that I began to love things like geometry. And when I began to learn to love history and astronomy, because all of those things coalesce in that book. If you've ever read that book, those sciences coalesce to create this wondrous depiction of what ancient peoples, of how they may have seen the world and why they may have built the pyramids and what they may have used the pyramids for. And you need to understand those sciences to understand the pyramids. So for the first time in my life, I felt like there was a reason to know mathematics and a reason to want to understand history. And it's that reason which is left out of schooling. And I want my children to love or to always love learning. I want them to have a healthy relationship with education. And I felt that the best way to do that was to homeschool them, to home educate them. So we've got, you know, a fairly good library of books that are available to them, you know, from very basic books for, you know, very young children to adult books about various topics, the mysteries of the world, as well as history, both conventional and non-conventional. So, yeah, that really kind of sums up my journey to homeschooling. My wife was a bit reluctant, not because she didn't understand my reasoning for wanting to homeschool, but because she didn't feel confident that she would be able to do it. I think even though it can be difficult at times, always being, you know, that, I mean, all of that responsibility is on you, and it's not so much the responsibility to teach them right, but it's the kind of energy that's required to be a hands-on parent full-time, 24 hours a day. You know, parents who send their children to school get 6-7 hours break a day, which sometimes sounds pretty enticing, I must admit. And I'm sure that my wife would agree with that. But I think that I know for a fact that she is happy with our decision to homeschool. She's glad we did it. I'm sure she's glad that I suggested it and pushed it, because I wasn't going to have it in any other way. I simply wasn't going to send my children to school. And this is years and years ago when things weren't half as bad as they are now with regards to the propaganda and conditioning and ridiculous, you know, so-called health measures that are in place over the last couple of years. So, yeah, great decision. Anyone out there who's got children and is unsure, I highly recommend it. Don't put too much pressure on yourself. You know, as long as you know that you can cover the basics, reading, writing, mathematics, then beyond that, you know, just have a computer to hand. Make sure that you have the ability to look up the things that you need to explain to them if you're unable to do it yourself. You know, and looking those things up together becomes part of the bonding experience as well. So, yeah, all in all, it's great. Right. So, yeah, I'll finish this episode by talking both about this year and next year. So as this is the last episode of the year of 2022, yeah, 2022 has been, God, what a year. It's been hands down the most stressful year of my life. I'm not gonna call it the worst year, because some great things have happened. You know, moving house, you know, to our homestead, that happened. But getting there, the heartache that we went through, the stress that we went through to get to this point was enormous. So on an individual level, it's been kind of a horrible year. I don't know how it's been for you, but yeah. Then obviously we have the so-called cost of living crisis, which is entirely engineered, of course. You know, what did they think was going to happen when they shut down the economy? What did they think was going to happen when they egged on the Ukraine-Russia war? You know, anyway, I'm not going to go into that side of things, but yeah, it's been a hell of a year. That said, it's also been the year where the Fergan podcast was conceived of and launched. So yeah, this podcast didn't exist prior to 2022. And I'm very grateful to everyone who has been listening to this and sharing episodes, and especially to patrons who've been helping to make it possible, because it does take a lot of time to organize, record, plan, research, edit, create the graphics and, you know, everything for to promote it. It does take time doing that, and your you know, the help of the donations of people who have been able to give them has made it possible, really. But yeah, anyone who's just been, you know, along for the journey with me, sharing the episodes, commenting, I'm grateful to all of you, because it's you know, one of the reasons I started the podcast was because a few friends of mine that pretty much begged me to start a podcast on paganism. And there are various reasons for that. One of them was because they felt that the only real pagan podcasts out there were by Americans, and they weren't too comfortable with the kind of American style of approach. They felt that it was too disconnected from the European, I don't know, traditions or just method of conveying information, I guess. I don't know exactly, but people ask me to do it. So I've never felt that I'm, you know, the most knowledgeable person out there about paganism or Northern European heathenry or religion in general, but I've got experience with it. I've been on a journey with it myself. Still got plenty to learn about it. So I've just been kind of sharing the last, 6 months, maybe more, like 9 months, I think I've been doing this now. Been sharing the journey of the last 9 months with all of you. And when you start to convey knowledge yourself, it forces you to become more knowledgeable. And I've also found that putting knowledge into practice, i.e. by speaking it, by conveying it, by being forced to explain it and put it into clear terms for people listening or reading, that helps you in your ability to understand things and to remember things. So it's been a learning experience for me as well as for anyone listening, you know, and I'm sure there are many of you who are listening who are probably more knowledgeable about certain aspects of paganism than I am. And I always welcome feedback on anything and discussion. And, you know, we have both the private Fergan Telegram group and we have the public one. I always reply to emails that anyone sends. So, yeah, if you want to discuss anything with me or even correct me on things, then, yeah, you can feel free. And I will always take that on board. We can learn from one another. So, yeah, the podcast has been a high point. Moving to the homestead has been a high point, even though, as I say, the journey to get here has been horrible. The so-called cost of living crisis has been horrendous for most people. There was pretty much a drought here in Britain during the summer in certain parts, especially southern England. So that wasn't so good. Then we had quite a harsh spell this winter, and there'll probably be more to come. Yeah, and even though the whole COVID psyop, the non-demic, seems to have kind of been put on the back burner, the after effects of it, the psychological effects of it, and I spoke about this on my millennial appearance a week or two ago, it's, you know, the psychological aspects of that have been so damaging to people. There's a general lethargy about people. A lot of people seem to have kind of given up fighting and kind of resigned themselves to the kind of lifestyle that they were already heading towards prior to 2020, but heading towards unconsciously, whereas now they head towards it knowingly, you know, realizing that they are beholden to the system, to the state, and that they, you know, the middle class will be smashed, that disposable income will become diminished, that life is just generally going to become more difficult, and that going out, traveling, And, you know, we have the 30-minute, this proposition of the 30-minute city in Oxford, which they're going to be introducing, where, you know, this is going to come in everywhere, where they're going to be trying to get everyone to accept the idea that you basically remain housebound most of the time, and you live your life through TV screens and smartphones and Zoom calls. So we really need to break out of that spell for next year, definitely. My plans for the future, I'll just talk a little bit. So someone asked me if I could just talk a little bit about how I'm getting on in Wales. And I actually thought about doing a whole episode about this, and maybe there's more to speak about here, and maybe I will. But Wales is a beautiful country in terms of the landscape. If you're not familiar with it, Wales is, if you're not from Britain, then you may not know that Wales is essentially the kind of more mountainous, rugged side of Britain. You know, England, for the most part, tends to be the flatter, more tamed lands of Britain, you know, mainly the south and eastern side of Britain. And then north of that, you have Scotland, obviously you have the Scottish Highlands, and west of that, you have Wales. So those are the more rugged lands of Britain. So Wales is a very beautiful country because of its topography. It's less easy to develop. So it is less densely populated than most of England is. And this is the main reason I moved here. It's wilder. It's less densely populated. Now, I did have some reservations about being an Englishman with an English family moving to Wales, particularly Northern Wales. Some of you may know, some of you may not know, but since the 1980s, there have been various spates of Welsh nationalists actually burning down homes belonging to English people. And there is this widely held idea that there is a certain anti-English sentiment among the Welsh. Now, the Welsh are a people who have impressively preserved and held on to their native language. And I think because of that, partly because of that, there is this sense of, well, there's definitely a sense of being different to the English. The Welsh nationalists who burnt down English homes were, as I understand it, they were predominantly targeting holiday homes, like second homes that were owned by wealthy English people. Now, this is something I actually completely support. You know, I don't support illegal acts, of course, but the sentiment of being angry at wealthy English people buying up Welsh properties as second homes and holiday homes and things, I completely support that, because Wales is actually one of the poorest regions of Western Europe. A lot of people don't know that, but most of Wales is actually quite poor. It's very rural. Most people have jobs which are related to the rural industry, or they live near the cities like Cardiff, Swansea, and you know, Newport, Wrexham, which is just over the border in North Wales. And it's a poor but proud place. And I was a bit reticent about moving here as an Englishman, but I have to say that I've been kind of bowled over by the warmth of the Welsh people. That, you know, we held a little social gathering at our house a couple of weeks ago and invited the nearest neighbours, and they're about half Welsh, half English. You know, there are quite a lot of English people who live round here. You know, if you go just over the border from England into Wales, there are lots of English people. And it's not until you get right out into the west, particularly the northwest, Anglesey and Carnarvon and stuff like that, that you find lots of that you predominantly Welsh people. So there are quite a few English people around where I live, and the English and the Welsh around here get on swimmingly, really, really well. And the Welsh locals around here, they speak Welsh to one another, which I think is brilliant. And I do intend to learn at least some basic Welsh because I believe in showing respect. I believe when you move to a country, then you should show respect to the local culture, the language, the people of that land. So, the Welsh people are wonderful. They're proud. They, long may the Welsh language survive. And, I look forward to getting to know more of them, to be honest. Of course, I will always be proudly English. That's never going to change, no matter where I live. My children are English. But that's not through feeling better or superior to the Welsh. It's just what I am. And the Welsh are equally wonderful and should be just as proud of their identity as the English are of theirs. What would I do differently if I made the move again? Nothing really, because all of the obstacles that we've come across in the act of moving to Wales are ones which we couldn't have foreseen. So there's no point in me wishing that I'd done things differently, because when you make a big move like I have, there are going to be complications, and that's going to be the case whether you move from the south of England to the north of England, from England to Scotland, from England to Wales, from England to Ireland, from Ireland to England, from, England to Germany, from, wherever you move. If you make a big move, there are going to be unexpected complications and you just have to deal with them. So, I'm glad I made the move. And, we'll see what the future holds. For now, it's a great place to be. It's a beautiful place to be. And, we're happy. So, to end this this podcast, this monologue, I'm just going to talk a little bit about 2023. What can we expect? How do we face it? How certain can we be that what we might predict is going to happen is going to happen? I think my prediction is that this cost of living crisis is going to be pushed to the point where the majority of people in Britain and Europe, I believe things are particularly difficult in places like Germany and the Netherlands. I think it's going to be pushed to the point where the majority of normal people can't cope any longer with the cost of living. And because my view is, and those of you who saw my millennial appearance will know my views on this, but my view is that the whole purpose of this fabricated, orchestrated, artificial rise in the expense of living, of energy costs, and just, general costs, food costs, insurance costs, property costs, taxes rising as well. One of the main reasons that they've done this is because they want or they need people to accept their universal basic income, which they want to introduce over the next few years. It's a classic case of problem reaction solution. Which I believe explains most of the things which are going on geopolitically. So the problem is, of course, people can't afford to live. The reaction is that people cry out in agony and demand that the government do something about it. And the solution is, of course, universal basic income. And it will eventually be tied to CBDCs, central bank digital currencies. So whether they're going to manage to achieve that in 2023, I'm not sure, but I do think they're going to make giant steps towards it, at least this year. If the cost of living continues to increase as it has done over the last few months, then breaking point will occur in 2023. So if that is the case, then we may well see certainly a significant form of universal basic income. We'll see that arrive in some kind of significant form. There was an article in the Irish Independent recently which talked about a study which said that income tax would only need to be about 40% to grant every citizen in Ireland, I think, something like €1,500 per month, universal basic income, that is. So they're already trying to soften the public mind ready for the introduction of something like this. So I think we're going to see that in 2023. Obviously, as I say, that means that there's hardship to come first. And in order to receive relief from that hardship, you would have to accept this universal basic income. Now, funnily enough, even though I speak very negatively about universal basic income, it's only dangerous when it's tied to CBDCs. And the reason for that is because that's when it becomes programmable, i.e. that's when it comes with conditions attached to it, i.e. you have to behave a certain way. In the case of the 30-minute city, which they want Oxford to be, it will mean that if you break the rules, if you leave the city too many times in a year or spend too much time away from it, whatever the rules are going to be, if you do those things, then your granted universal basic income may be lessened. Maybe you'll be docked €500 for committing certain so-called crimes. Many of you listening probably accept some form of welfare and probably need to do so. I'm in full support of that. I think whilst you're able to, take what you can from this corrupt system. But the key thing is not to become dependent on it, because if they take that away from you, then you're in trouble if you're dependent on it. So take that money and make sure you invest it in the means to be self-sufficient if they take it away from you. So use their money against them. Use their money, their welfare, to become more independent. So if they do introduce something like universal basic income, we need to be using that to prepare ourselves for a future where we won't be recipients of universal basic income, i.e. when it will be tied to a CBDC digital handout and when it will have conditions attached to it. So I think that may be on the cards this year. Maybe it won't happen as soon as 2023. Maybe it'll be 2024, 2025. What we do know is that their agenda of sustainability is currently named Agenda 2030. So this is because they want to achieve most of, if not all, of their sustainable goals by 2030. So that's actually not that far away, and they are going hell for leather to achieve those goals as soon as possible. And that does include their UBI, because the only way they can force us to live sustainably, to use their terminology, the only way they can force us to do that is by having a means of forcing us to behave a certain way. And their best method of doing that in the near future will be the carrot rather than the stick. So it will be this idea that you can have free money to help with the cost of living, but only if you live sustainably. So I think that's probably the major thing that I'm going to be looking for in 2023. In the meantime, until that arrives, we're going to suffer the hardships of a high cost of living. So I think to learn to heat our homes in you know, by using things like firewood or to simply wear more clothes. I think we need to get good at doing these things. We need to become very canny at being efficient with money. And one of the things that I often say in the, both in this podcast and on the Telegram channel is that we need to get good at living with as little money as possible, because they can't bribe us if we don't need their money. You know, it's as simple as that. And you may say, oh, yeah, but I don't need their money because I have a job. I earn well, you know. I don't, but a lot of people do, thankfully. A lot of people still do have a good amount of disposable income. I would suggest to them that they invest that disposable income rather than spending it on useless things, because industry will continue to fail and change. They want to get rid of all unsustainable industries. So, I mean, you can look at their sustainable goals to see what that entails. You know, anything probably involving farming, independent farming, certainly, the production of meat and dairy, probably. Airlines, anyone who works in the air industry, airports, aeroplanes, things like that. Probably, I would say, social activities, pubs, bars, maybe even restaurants will start to change in nature. I think, you know, the home delivery of food will probably start to replace eating out. You know, they want us to live in this so-called sustainable way, which essentially means living and working from home and interacting with the world through a screen. So any type of industry that you may work in which doesn't play into that type of lifestyle may start to diminish in terms of how lucrative it is, how healthy the industry is. So we'll see. I don't want to fearmonger too much. I just think that people need to at least start considering what they would do if they lost their job. Or some people can't even bear the thought of not receiving a pay rise every year or a Christmas bonus. You know, to people like myself who are self-employed, those things don't exist anyway, so we're not accustomed to them. But some people rely on them, and obviously we're seeing strikes in the UK by the NHS and the Royal Mail Postal Service, because from what I gather, workers want to be paid more. And that's all well and good. I don't begrudge them using their whatever means they can to improve their situation, but none of us are receiving pay rises. Most of us aren't receiving pay rises. So, you know, this is just the way things are going to go. So, yeah, it's difficult to predict more beyond that in 2023, whether they might try another kind of so-called COVID outbreak. I don't know. They're definitely talking about digital IDs. They're going to push that forward. We're seeing more shops around the world introducing this no-pay system where you simply walk out and cameras, this is an Amazon thing, cameras have worked out what you've picked up while you've been around the store and automatically bill you and things like that. So we are moving into a more and more digital society. I say we because people like myself and hopefully most of you listening will not participate in these kind of things. So we need to continue to try and build our sort of somewhat parallel society to mitigate the worst aspects of the digital mainstream. And yeah, let's continue to push ahead with that. And I think staying positive, upholding morale throughout the coming years is going to be one of the most difficult things. I find myself becoming anxious more regularly because of what's going on in the world. And it can be crippling, and I know a lot of people out there feel it. So we need to be there for one another. We need to, certainly we need to grasp onto our spiritual traditions strongly. And as I talked about earlier with these rituals that we could be doing, these kind of, you know, like the Native Americans do their peyote rituals, these things can be so life-affirming. And we need to engage in that as often as possible rather than withdraw from it, because it's those things which give us the strength and the joy to continue fighting. So, yeah, I think that pretty much does it for this episode. And I hope that you've all had a good year. You know, I certainly hope that you've had a better year than I have. And I hope you've had a wonderful Yuletide with family. And I wish you an extremely meaningful and healthy 2023. And I'll be there for my folk as much as I can be. And yeah, try and be there for others around you. And I think that's another thing, actually. Another thing that I intend to do a lot is to really nurture the friendships that I have and not hold back. That's something that I have a tendency to do, is to kind of keep people at arm's length. But actually, the friends that we have now, especially the ones who see things roughly the same way that we do, they're so valuable. I mean, we cannot overstate how valuable those people are. And so we need to love them fully, and we need to embrace them fully, and we need to spend as much time as possible with them, talking with them, giving them support, asking for support from them, nurturing brotherhoods and sisterhoods. It's going to be really, really important in the coming year. So I would humbly suggest that if you have people like that in your life, make sure that they know how valuable they are to you, and be valuable to them in return. So yeah, lastly for this episode of the podcast, the Fergan podcast, we'll go to the Exeter Riddle book. And last episode's riddle was number 23, and that was quite an obvious one. We had a couple of quite abstract, difficult riddles before that, but this one, the answer is bow. The answer to this one says, the first word of the riddle is agoff, which read backwards gives foga, which is an earlier form of boga, bow. The archer was by no means a commonplace of Anglo-Saxon warfare. Indeed, it was essentially the massed archers and the cavalry who enabled the Normans to scrape home at Hastings. So, yeah, I mean, that was a really good... I enjoyed that riddle, actually. I remember that one. You know, Wob's my name, if you work it out. Wob, obviously, being the modern English translation of Foga. Goffa. Let me just return to that. Whatever it was, the old archaic word for bow, agoff, sorry. So originally that was agoff, and it has now been made into wob. Wob's my name, if you work it out. I'm a fair creature fashioned for battle. When I bend and shoot a deadly shaft from my stomach, I desire only to send that poison as far away as possible. So yeah, that was quite a good one, quite an obvious, easy one. But sometimes the easier ones tend to be the most poetic. So, yeah. So for this episode number 24, I shall now read riddle number 24, which is as follows. I'm a strange creature with various voices. I can bark like a dog, bleat like a goat, honk like a goose, shriek like a hawk. At times I imitate the ashen eagle, the battle bird's cry. The vulture's croak trips off my tongue, and the mew of the seagull, as I sit here saucily. G suggests my name, and ah, ah, and O assist it. So do H and I. I'm called what these six characters clearly spell out. So if I were to spell out that word using those letters, it would read Garohi. Garohi. I'm not knowledgeable enough about Old English to know whether that is a word or whether it's a anagram of a word, which it may well be. But as always, we'll look at the answer to that riddle together in the next episode of the Fergan podcast. And as always, I thank you all for listening. Visit fergan.com for merchandise, for an archive of past episodes, or if you want to contact me for any reason, feel free. And yeah, have a wonderful rest of your Yuletide and an excellent New Year's Eve. And let's get off to 2023 with a great start, and let's be there for one another. So thank you all for listening, and be well until I speak to you next time.